Welcome to Leadership Reimagined, where game-changing conversations are reshaping the world of work. I'm Janice Ellig, the CEO and founder of Ellig Group, Executive Search Advisors, where we are reimagining search through our longstanding commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion. On today's topic, a CEO's commitment, thriving communities drive corporate success. I am delighted to welcome Tim Spence, President, CEO, and Director of Fifth Third Corp, a top 20 bank by assets. Before being named CEO in 2022 and President in 2020, Tim joined Fifth Third in 2015 as Chief Strategy Officer and later became head of Consumer Bank, responsible for Fifth Third's retail banking, mortgage, auto, specialty lending, and payments, as well as key strategic growth capabilities such as digital, marketing, and fintech partnerships. Prior to joining Fifth Third, Tim was a senior partner in the financial services practice at Oliver Wyman. Recognized for his innovative vision in significantly advancing Fifth Third's digital transformation, in 2018, American Banker honored Tim as Digital Banker of the Year. Tim believes that banks like Fifth Third can be a catalyst for positive change in communities, and he demonstrates this through his service to various higher education and economic development organizations in Ohio and beyond. Tim is a founding member of Fifth Third's Enterprise Diversity Leadership Council, established in 2020, and he's the executive sponsor of the African American Business Resource Group. During these very busy times for banks, Tim, I am delighted you could join us today.
Thanks, Janice. It's great to be here.
Well, these are interesting times, and I want to talk a little bit about your leadership and some of those interesting facts that I've read about in terms of your upbringing and what might have contributed to your success today. So I've read that you learned to code in the first grade. You grew up breaking apart and reassembling electronics such as toasters and computers. Your dad was a financial planner with UBS, and he taught you how to read financial statements at an early age, and that you set an ongoing goal to read 20 pages a day, and you're a runner. So are these some of the drivers that got you to be the youngest CEO of a top 10 bank in the U.S. at the age of 43?
Thanks for the question. And it's funny to reflect back on all those things, I think, in particular, in times like the one that we find ourselves in. I, at least, become very appreciative of the experience that I had for so many years, including experiences that maybe didn't seem like they were going to be relevant to the future, where all of a sudden you find yourself looking back and a lesson. I mean, narrowly to your question about what got me to where I am career-wise, I actually don't think it's any of those things. I think it's people. I had people at several hard forks in my life, whether they were educational forks or character-defining forks or career forks, who nudged me in one direction or another. You know, folks who took a risk on hiring me, including the person who hired me at Oliver Wyman, actually overruled the other partners on the interview slate. Or folks like our prior CEO, Greg Carmichael, who gave me the opportunity here, but constantly pushed me to get what I needed to get done in a given area done in a period of 24 months and to get the right talent in behind me so that I could go on to the next thing. And as I look back on my own career, it is like absolutely, invariably, it's those people that really got me to where I was. Now that said, I do think all of the other things that you mentioned are important. I mean, I have always been curious, and I was fortunate to grow up in a house where it was okay to break stuff as long as you could figure out how to put it back together. I think that taught me to understand how things work, maybe at a different level. I did learn. I mean, I was learning Turtle Basic, so it was a very basic coding, and then through computer science courses in college and otherwise learned a series of like things that would be the digital equivalent of the Rosetta Stone today in terms of dead programming languages.
Right.
But they were valuable because they forced you to be able to express your thought in a different language, right? And absolutely, when I had a decent run at the age of 12 or 13 mowing neighbors' lawns, and my dad thought it would be a good idea at that age to teach me how to read a financial statement so that I could start investing money instead of spending it on stuff. All of those things, along with what I get out of the books are as much as anything a stress relief tool, but they're frames, right? They're like holding an empty picture frame up to the world, and you can kind of pick what frame you look at a problem through. And when you do that and you have a good collection of frames, it causes you to see the world in different ways. And we've all probably had that experience if we framed a piece of art that we have hanging on the wall, like the right frame makes the painting. So those things are valuable, especially in times of uncertainty, in helping to triangulate a strategic course or a course of action.
Obviously, some of these things that you grew up with did shape who you are today, right? In terms of that intellectual curiosity. So I just want to talk a little bit about your leadership. What do you look for in leaders coming in terms, is it that intellectual curiosity, particularly when, you know, like we are during very difficult times right now? Being able to pivot and being agile, really important in decision-making. So what do you look for in your leaders?
You know, that's a great question. I think at the most fundamental level, there are three things that you look for in leaders, certainly that I do. One is the ability to set vision. And by vision, I don't mean, you know, develop a strategic plan or a thesis for the way that a market will play out, although that is part of it. It's the ability to both understand the circumstances at a level that allows you to anticipate future developments, but also then to understand yourself and that yourself as a leader, your organization, right, the collection of people that you're responsible for, and then the attributes of the business so that you can set a course, which includes the strategic investments, but also the culture and the talent model. And the operating rhythms that need to support it. The second thing then is the ability to get talent, right? And that's both attracting great people, but it's also about how you develop great people and how you mold great people into teams. One of the questions that I like to ask groups of people when I get together inside our company is this a collection of individuals or is it a team? And you'll find that there are some organizations that sort of function okay as a collection of individuals. It just is not a good model in a company like ours. So you have to have the ability to get great people, but then you got to be able to get those great people to believe in something that's bigger than they are and to want to be part of something that asks them at least at the margin to subordinate their own personal motivations for the sake of the whole. The last thing then is the ability to drive execution. And in particular, in a business like ours, which is very tightly connected to the economic cycle and influenced by factors that are outside your control, your ability to take a plan, the vision that you've developed, and the collection of people that you've gathered to deliver it, and then to navigate the unexpected changes and to be able to adapt and still get the outcomes that you expect is a unique skill in and of itself.
Well, in today's world where talent is really at a premium, I mean, it is a supply issue. You've mentioned in the past that people can come to Fifth Third and have like 8 careers and they don't have to leave. How do you hold on to your people? How do you make that happen where they can really want to be there and stay with you?
Yeah. You know, I was with one of our leaders the other day. She was celebrating her 30th anniversary with the company.
Wow.
How many careers have you had inside the bank? And it was more than a dozen. So I may be shooting too low when I say 8. This idea of 8 careers isn't mine. It came from our HR folks who told me that the kids who graduate college these days will probabilistically have 8 different careers before they get to retire 30 to, you know, 40 years into the future. And I think in a world where there are going to be more people retiring every year than there are coming out of high school and college, a big part of the game is going to be finding ways to inspire people with the ways in which they can grow inside our company as opposed to going outside. I mean, some people may graduate from college and know exactly what they wanted to do, but I certainly was not one of those. Like, if you actually sat back and plotted out my career course, it would look more like a random walk through the forest than it would a straight line. So part of the way that you keep them in that environment is by making sure that the opportunities exist to go through that unique personal exploration that I think most of us have in our 20s and 30s to sort of figure out where you have that intersection of the things that you're passionate about and what you're good at. I think the second thing, which is a little bit contrarian, or at least was the last couple of years, is that I am a big believer in the value of place. I think that we are all less aware than we should be of the impact that the environment has on us and that the impact that other people have on us. And if you create a great place and you have people in it, great things tend to happen, right? Spontaneous things that you didn't expect tend to happen. Relationships build, the new connections get made, that creates career avenues, it creates friendships and social bonds. The office is like one of the last places in society where you really do draw together people from all different backgrounds and perspectives and remind them that there are fundamental beliefs that are shared and a commonality of purpose. And I think that extends beyond just your office building. It also is the way that you handle what we think of as our campus, which is like the area immediately around our office and the other employers that inhabit that space. We did some things in our Cincinnati headquarters this past fall that start to work on creating a young professionals group that actually cuts across major employers here in Cincinnati. And that was actually born out of one of my own experiences and moving to a new city where I didn't know anybody, call it 20 years ago, and in struggling to find people who may have shared common interests or otherwise. So I ended up throwing my own parties. And if you brought someone, if you were invited, you brought somebody that nobody else in the room knew, you got to eat for free. And you didn't have to kick in to cover the beer and the wine. But if anybody else in the room knew your guest, then you had to pay your fair share of the bill. And it created a network of young people in that community that wouldn't otherwise have existed. And I think that's the same sort of an idea here, is we have to be much more focused on the ways in which we create real networks as opposed to sort of ad-supported social networks.
Yeah, as we do recruiting for many clients, we find that purpose-driven organizations, people are attracted there. They want to go someplace, almost any age in today's world, they want to go someplace where they're going to have an impact and feel part of a community that's doing good. And I have to commend you for what you're doing at Fifth Third, because you've said, and that's the topic of today, really, you cannot be successful. Organizations can't, Fifth Third can't be successful unless communities are successful. And that, and I'll quote you, too many of our Black and Brown citizens and their neighborhoods have been shut out or left behind over the course of the past many, many decades. So you, as leader at Fifth Third, and I guess your predecessor as well, are making significant investments to accelerate that equality in community. So tell us how you're doing that, what this holistic approach is, because I think this is so significant. People want to work for organizations that are doing good and making good at the same time.
Yeah. You know, I have to give my predecessor and longtime boss, Greg Carmichael, credit in this area. I mean, I think it's 8 years ago now we entered into a community benefits agreement that, at least to my knowledge, is the only community benefits agreement that's been done in the past decade that wasn't tied to getting a merger approval. Greg just did it because he was looking at the footprint and he was looking at how we wanted to be seen as an actor in the community. And it just felt like the right thing to do. So that five-year, $30 billion commitment, which we later upsized a little bit, really was the start of us thinking differently about the role we play in our community. I like to remind our people, and I'll tell you this, turmoil in the banking sector right now has been probably the strongest reminder that we've had, that banks are only as strong as their customers and the communities where they operate. Like, for every $10 of loans we make, if you just look at the banking sector balance sheet, about a dollar comes from shareholders' capital, and $9 comes from your customers, right? And as a byproduct of that, if your customers have confidence in your company and believe that you are a constructive member of the community where they live, and they have faith in the bank, then the bank's funding base is stable. And if the people that you're loaning money to are making prudent investments, are creating economic opportunities for a broad cross-section of the population, and therefore are boosting employment and savings, then homes get bought, and community participation, you can actually see this in the data, goes up in terms of civic involvement, and things go really well. But if those things are not there, if the customers don't feel vested in the bank, if the bank has not been clear about the connectivity it has in its communities, and or if it's attached to communities that are undergoing significant traction and it's not helping them to see a bridge to the other side, then things can unravel pretty quickly.
But some of the outcomes you look at, which are like high school graduation rates, more green space and beautification, I mean, how are you measuring those outcomes? You're making these investments in these communities. So the outcomes you're looking for, what are they?
What I think I would say is that the measure we want is vitality. We want communities to be healthier. In the specific case of the investments we've made in some of the neighborhoods across the footprint, which I do think is among the more innovative things we've done, certainly in that area, is how well they function. So if you think about a neighborhood that's healthy, like it has a health, we just think about the ones that you visit. There's a healthy commercial strip. And the anchors of that commercial strip are generally, you say, what needs to be there? There needs to be fresh food. There needs to be financial services. And generally, there needs to be urgent care, right? There are places where people can meet that are safe and common and where they can recreate together, right? Whether that's green space, certainly in the case of our southeastern markets, it's green space. And some of the ones we have in the upper Midwest, it's more like an enclosed community center, just given the weather, but it's common space. And then that there is participation in the improvement in the community, right? I think one of the things that has been frustrating in many of the urban neighborhoods which have redeveloped is that they have both triggered displacement on one hand, and that the equity that goes into the neighborhood to improve it and that benefits from price appreciation comes from outside the neighborhood. So it is the degree to which you're able to retain the wealth creation that comes from things getting better inside the neighborhood itself and with the residents of the neighborhood who were there previously. Some of it then, if it's not about the ability to recapture the wealth, bridge the home ownership gap, build the equity in the community, has to do with just making sure that for those folks who don't participate in the growth in home prices, as an example, that they don't get displaced. And we have been able to do some interesting things there through helping a couple of our neighborhoods establish these community trusts, which then acquire the property that gets redeveloped and allows them to control and to essentially endow that community with permanently affordable housing. And then to create a source of cash for the community to invest in other areas. And then I think lastly, what is interesting about many of the neighborhoods we've chosen is they're proximate to major employers or the central business district. And so you want to see more participation in the jobs that are available in the immediate area or in the purchasing that's available in the immediate area. We have a hospital partner in one of the neighborhoods who's just done an outstanding job of looking at everything that they buy and saying, what can we buy from neighbors, like literally people living in the 2 to 3 mile radius around the hospital campus. And then I think lastly, it's education and its achievement rates. And our role as a bank is to be a provider of equity in some cases, to be a lender in some cases, and to use our influence in the community because of the business relationships we have or the relationships we have with the local politicians to be a convener and to bring attention to the issues and the opportunities and to get the right group of voices around the table to work directly with the residents to be able to drive change.
And I want to remind our audience, you're listening to Tim Spence, A CEO's Commitment, Thriving Communities Drive Corporate Success. Tim is the Fifth Third's President, CEO, and Board Director. The topics we cover like today's are all current, and a new topic with a new game changer is released every month. This is a great way to stay current on relevant issues that are happening around us. Now let's return to Tim Spence. So these economic development models you're driving are truly innovative and in so many different ways, and you're putting the power in the hands of the citizens. So is there anything that like this audience can take away and do in their own communities or how we can work more with our local banks such as yours?
You know, I think that there are probably two things. The first and most important thing that you can do if you want to help is to listen to the people that you want to help. And that's part of that is making sure that they feel like they need it. And part of that is, I think I've learned from many of these neighborhoods that our perspective as an outsider looking in on what needed to change, if oftentimes was that we had the right list of items, but we didn't understand the priority the way that the residents in the neighborhood understand the priority. So the initial impetus, certainly as a corporate partner, is to kind of parrot, you know, I'm Mr. Smith and I'm in from Washington and here to help. that is the wrong way to approach these problems. The second thing is to recognize that if the issues in the community that you're working in or with were easy to fix, they would have been fixed, right? There's been no shortage of effort in a lot of places. But what you find is that the issues are really systemic issues. And when you recognize that, it both changes your perspective on how committed you need to be, right? In our case, I think it's really caused us to think we agreed that we were going to spend 3 years working on 10 neighborhoods as part of this neighborhood program. It's probably going to be more like 5 years by the time we're done here. And it may not be five, it may be more than that, because I certainly was overly optimistic about the pace with which we could address some of the more sustained structural issues, you know, when you recognize that the problem is hard, the fact that you may not have immediate success is, you know, easier to palate. Because you don't undo 50 years of exclusion in a week or a month or a year, or as I mentioned, as I've learned in 3 years.
So, you know, I've heard from your staff that they have to have running shoes to keep up with you. And so, you know, part of this, what you're talking about, is that you want things to accelerate quicker. And at Fifth Third, you've had many firsts over its 160-year history. So What are you looking to drive to continue to be a leader? What's going to be important for you in the strategy going forward?
So thanks for mentioning it. You're right. You wouldn't think that a bank headquartered in the Midwest that as recently as 30 or 40 years ago was a few billion dollars and, you know, a handful of cities would have been as involved in the development of a lot of the technology that we just sort of take for granted in the banking system today. But it was. We have a little corporate museum that we built in this beautiful atrium that my predecessor invested in that we use primarily to teach employees our history. But I sneak down there every once in a while and I watch the videos because, you know, you watch a wall being taken out in the building so that they could use a crane to move computing machines in. Or you hear the stories about, you know, Fifth Third invented the first online ATM network in the U.S. But we didn't have the foresight to understand how much cash would be required. So one of our IT people literally had to stand in the cabinet behind the ATM and keep feeding the canister with new bills as the money came out. But I say that both because it sort of explains why the company has been as proactive as it has been to adopt new technology. But also, I try to remind our people that a big part of innovation is just the willingness to like put something into the world and figure it out, right? And to make it work. And that's hard inside a large company, in part because you have this responsibility to all of your existing clients. Like if I'm starting a business from scratch and I put a product out and it doesn't work that well, the only people it impacts are the handful of folks who bought it before I figure it out. But if Fifth Third makes a change to our mobile app or we change a fraud rule and it impacts card authorizations on, you know, a Friday afternoon, which is a payday, it impacts millions of people immediately out of the gate. So you have to be more thoughtful about what you put out in the world, but that doesn't mean that you can't find ways to be innovative. So I tell our people all the time, you want to grow organically and take market share in a mature and highly competitive market, which ours is with, you know, 4,000 banks or something like that across the U.S., you have to do something differently. If you just do what everybody else is doing, you get, you know, 1/4,000th of a share, or if there are 50 banks in your market, 1/50th of the share. So we do expect, as a matter of course of doing business, that people step back and evaluate the product set, evaluate the sales and service channels, and challenge themselves to say, is there anybody doing this better? I in fact, myself, every week I have a multi-hour slot that's blocked out, and I walk the walls and do a teardown on one of 14 different products or critical focus products inside the company that we've identified, and then one of 14 critical value streams, as we call them, these end-to-end processes that cut across our organization. And those things are selected based on the role they play in our customers' lives. So we're very focused as a relationship bank on the stuff you've got to do as a business or a consumer every day, or up to as frequently as 1 month. And we want to be the company that does the best job of helping you solve those issues or take advantage of those opportunities, like completely, not a little bit, or giving you a tool you can use to do the job. We want the tools to do the job for you if they can. And so you have to be really deliberate as a leader about the way in which you not only set that expectation and explain to people why it's important, but then again, back to our prior conversation about what you expect from leaders, about the way that you inspect the progress on an ongoing basis. And that as a leader, you're willing to take some of the risk as opposed to just letting people loose and then, you know, challenging them when things don't work out.
Yeah. So your leadership is a lot about the why. Why are we doing these things, right? Why will this make an impact on our customers? Is that important for all of your leaders throughout the organization in terms of how they approach their jobs every day. And when you talk about technology, is technology to further enable them in terms of the why and then the how and the what?
I think the why is like a non-negotiable in a modern business environment. I'm very fond of a book. It was Neil Ferguson who wrote it. He's a British historian that is called, it's something to the tune of The Tower and the Square, but it basically describes that throughout history, this ongoing battle between networks and hierarchies. And his basic argument was that networks, if you just look at the sweep of history, always beat out hierarchies in terms of organizational models. But then ironically, the networks then tend to metastasize into hierarchies themselves, and they get toppled again later. So in my own personal experience, network teams, that is flat organizations where you have a broader base of empowerment, are able to move faster and are able to pivot more nimbly and do a better job of understanding what the customer need is and or how to address a specific financial issue or opportunity that materializes better than traditional hierarchical organizations. But if you're going to get you're going to run in a flat model, the leaders across the top of that organization all have to be keenly bought into and understand the implications of why you're doing things. Because if they don't understand the why, if they just understand the what, then the only way that you can really get an organization to be coordinated and to make a concerted impact is by just telling them how to do what they need to do, which puts you back into more of a hierarchical sort of a structure. So I think the why is just practically necessary to run a flat organization. I also think it's in a world where people want purpose out of their work, if you don't understand the why, you're kind of purposeless. And being purposeless is a miserable idea.
You know, it sounds to me like your employees, if they know the why, they're going to feel really empowered to go ahead and make those decisions. And then responsibility is delegated to the lowest possible level, because you, Tim Spence, as CEO, can't really be in all places at all times, right? You need your people to act focused on that customer. And so you're giving them that information.
Yeah. Plus, I'm wrong a lot. and I want us to be right as a company much more frequently than I'm going to be right as an individual.
Well, you had many accolades. So let me ask, what are you most proud of? And why is this important to you in terms of the bank, your employees, and the communities?
I am most proud at the end of the day of the impact that we get to have out in the world. I think I love the fact that the bank under my predecessor really underwent an incredible transformation. We de-risked the company. We did a series of very hard things to create one of the most profitable banks of our size, and to invest strategically in either capabilities or markets that are going to really continue to support our growth. And I'm really proud of all those things. I like the fact that we're profitable. I like the fact that were viewed as being one of the most stable and trusted banks. And I love getting to see the organic growth. But, you know, we're 20,000 people. And those 20,000 people all live in markets where we operate, or at least if there are a few that don't, it's a limited number of those. And as I said earlier, our success really is a function of how well we support those communities. So every year on the 3rd of May, which happens to be 5/3 on the calendar, we celebrate Fifth Third Day. And we focus on food insecurity on that day. We're going to feed 10 million people across the footprint this May. So it's a big impact from the fundraising we do that day, the food packing we do, and otherwise. But the thing I enjoy more is, you know, reminding our people of the broader impact that they make throughout the year. Our employees donated about 120,000 hours of volunteer time last year. They sit on something like 1,150 nonprofit or education boards across the footprint. And they touch our customers' lives in really personal matters on a day in, day out basis, you know, over the course of the year. And just one simple example of how that manifested itself at the front end of the COVID lockdowns. You know, we have about 8.5 of our 20,000 people in the branches or out in the field, and then another few thousand folks in our operations centers. And those folks, for good reason, were deemed essential workers. And I personally was wrestling at the onset of the lockdown with how to explain to folks why it was unsafe for the people who worked in our office towers to come into the office when but safe for them and necessary for them out in the field. And it dawned on me, actually on a long run, that what we had to do was to help them to understand why they were essential, right? The fact that they were really frontline heroes, maybe not to the extent that somebody who worked in a hospital was, certainly, but that they were there to provide an essential service that allowed people's lives to go on. So I challenged our folks in our retail branches to make 1 million calls in the first week of the lockdown to customers just to check in on them and make sure they were all right. And then we took our strategy team and our marketing team offline and had them focus on building out a resource guide that included detail on all of the social services, all of the government lending support programs, and any other support services that we could think of that were relevant in the community. Not Fifth Third programs, because we had those developed, but the things that were available to everybody else. And our frontline folks didn't make 1 million calls. They made 3 million calls.
Oh, wow. That's incredible.
In a matter of a few weeks. And they went into their own pockets in some cases, because they would get a customer on the phone who was stuck at home, whose primary caregiver wasn't able to get to them, who was out of food and toiletries. And they literally sent people out from the branches to buy groceries and drop them off at the house. They helped people navigate, you know, what could be confusing forms. And the largest consumer sentiment company, consumer surveyor in the U.S., ran three surveys during COVID where they asked people across the country what financial institution did the best job of supporting you through the pandemic. And Fifth Third swept. We were number one of the 25 largest institutions in all three of those surveys. And that is the thing I'm most proud of.
Oh, that's incredible. You know, that really talks about and addresses the need for trust, doesn't it? In terms of you want to trust your financial institution, but you're really talking about trust in the people, because it's all people that make up, you know, the organization, right? So you've really built, and Greg Carmichael as well, an organization, a financial institution that when you have surveys like that and you come out number one during the pandemic, people turn to you. So I really commend you on what you're doing for, you know, communities throughout the country, and I know you're going to expand that. So I wanted to ask if you have any parting words for our audience in terms of where you see the future of financial institutions, the impact you want to make. I know you're a runner, so you think a lot about solving problems on your runs. So what do you think of the future for financial institutions in this country and building trust for society?
We're in for, you said it at the outset, interesting times here for a while, because our financial system is large and it is interrelated. And I think in an environment like that, we've kind of seen the pendulum swing in the last 24 months from, you know, crypto and this notion of decentralized finance and trustless finance being the hot topic to a world now where we're talking about too big to fail financial institutions as being the only place where you can trust. I think I am of the belief that it is not the capital markets that made the U.S. economy so innovative and so great over the course of the past 200 years. It is, in fact, the fact that we had a decentralized banking system. Because 150 years ago, you know, if you were somebody with an idea in Dayton, Ohio, in our footprint, or in Wilmington, North Carolina, the place you went to get investment was not the New York Stock Exchange. It was the local bank. Mm-hmm. And I continue to believe that the U.S. model of banking, even though it is occasionally going to be a little bit bumpier, is superior to a consolidated model of banking like you would see in Europe, where, you know, in any given market, call it five banks each have 20% market share, or 10 banks each have 10% market share. It's supportive of dynamism. It's supportive of capital flows going to the right places. So when I talk to the policymakers in Washington, certainly, and when I talk to our community partners and our own customers directly, that is the thing that I spend a lot of time on, is we don't want to solve short-term problems and create long-term ones. We want to solve short-term problems with solutions that are designed to promote, you know, an efficient allocation of capital, credit availability everywhere where it can be extended viably, and competition that supports, you know, sort of sustained product innovation and service innovation. And so that I think is the thing that I think a lot about, is how do we, as a large regional bank, as a dominant player in our markets, be an agent for constructive change, whether that's as an advocate for the regulatory framework that supports a better long-term market structure, or in some cases, just as the disruptor, right, who's challenging the status quo with new and better ways to operate. And as a source of strength for people, even though we, you know, our bank is denominated only in the hundreds of billions as opposed to in the trillions, when you look at the assets on our balance sheet.
Tim, this has been such an inspirational discussion, and I commend you, the board, your employees at Fifth Third, for really listening to people in communities in terms of what's needed. And before the fifth year, we will come back and see the progress that has been made, because you truly are impacting people's lives and society, and really making us less of a pay gap, less of a wealth gap, more equality for all. So Tim Spence, CEO, Director, President of Fifth Third Bancorp, thank you for joining us today and sharing an incredible story about a CEO's commitment, driving communities, drive corporate success.
Thanks, Janice.
Yes, it's really been phenomenal. And to our audience, thank you for joining us today for this game-changing conversation on Leadership Reimagined. And you can find me on Twitter, LinkedIn, or visit our website at ellagroup.com. So thank you all for joining us. And Tim Spence, again, thank you for a great discussion.